Welcome to Only Murders in My Mind, a Random Thought production. Hi, I'm Carol Bissett, a crime writer, and I invite you with my co-presenters, Liz Hedgecock and Mike Jackson, each week to our conversations on all things murderous. Hello again, and welcome to this episode of Only Murders in My Mind. I've got with me today Liz. Hi, Liz.
Hiya.
And where's Mike? He's still not here with us, but I'm sure he will be soon. Get well soon, Mike. We're missing you.
We are. It's very strange having this gap in the studio. I keep looking across and going, oh, he's not there.
We got, you know, he usually sits in a chair opposite me with his headphones on and everything. So, yeah, not the same without you.
It isn't. You are missed.
This is a person I'd never heard of, but when I've looked at the Ten Commandments of Ronald Knox on detection.
Blaster from the past here.
Yeah. Yep. I thought, this is interesting.
Only Murders in My Mind retro edition.
It is, yeah. But before we start that, are you managing to do actually any reading that isn't work-related, you know, just for pleasure?
Well, I'm actually between client edits at the moment, which is quite nice. I mean, I'm using the time partly to read through my own stuff. But yes, when I'm not doing that, I am currently reading a book called The Troublemakers, which is a middle grade book. I actually won this in a competition, and I'm going to probably donate it to the school that I work at when I finish. So I'm reading it first, and it's interesting. It's not remotely crime, although it has pirates in it, which is good, you know. So there's that. I am also currently reading a book about printmaking, and I'm reading a book called Hyperfocus, which is quite funny when you consider I'm already reading three books at one go. But you know, we'll park that one there. And I'm reading a book about making maps. So.
Oh, just a few things then.
Well, it's that thing of, I mean, the art books you can kind of pick up and put down once you've learnt about, you know, how to carve a potato or whatever, you know, fascinating thing they're telling you.
Exactly.
But, you know, Hyperfocus is like a non-fiction, and then Troublemakers is a fiction. So it's not as weird as it sounds. How about you?
Just on two at the moment. I'm on, and this is an audiobook, and it's The Charming Man, which is the second in Strange Times
series. I want to
get
to that, and I haven't yet.
It's really good, and I'm re-listening, and I know a lot of people going, oh no. I'm going through the whole of the Agatha Raisin books in order. And reading them at night when, and the reason I read them at night when I'm in bed is because A, I've read them before, but like I said to you, Liz, I'm terrible for buying series halfway through and then just jumping from one book to another and thinking, well, she says she's divorced from him, but when did she marry him?
Oh no, I've got to read in order.
Yeah, so I'm actually doing that at the moment, and I find, because I do have trouble sleeping and my sleep pattern is atrocious, I can pick this up and put it down, and it's very light reading, you know. Mm-hmm. They're not long books, they're not complicated. But yes, there's a couple of books that I've got lined up. Erica James, that's not crime, that's usually family dramas and you know, sort of love stories wound in. She's just released a book recently, and I'm a big fan of her book, so I'm going to take that on holiday with me and read it on holiday.
So. Do you find that your reading informs your writing?
Yes.
Does it influence what you're doing at that time?
Yeah. I mean, some of the people that I've read when it comes to crime, I definitely pick up on what I like about their writing and try and put a little bit of that into my writing without obviously not copying it, because it's my own translation of it. But when I read something, I think, I could write. I mean, originally when I first started writing crime, the first book was very much an experiment. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of, I'd just read about four or five of Val McDermott's books.
Ah, right, yes.
So that's sort of where it came from. And I thought, you know, I'll try and do something along those lines. Again, as you know, I like to do a lot of the science side besides the forensics and things like
yes.
that. I find all that side of it fascinating. But
mm-hmm.
yes, it does. I think it must with you as well.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's always the book I'm on, but quite often I'll sort of make a note of something and sort of store it up for later. So,
yeah. You do it without realising it though, don't you? You
know? Yeah.
I know in this one I've just finished writing, there's quite a few elderly people in it, and I sort of model them on people I know that go to church. Perhaps from even from my past and the way the way they react to life, they come from quite a different sort of viewpoint very often, you know. Sort of.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that's come over as being genuine and a little bit quirky.
Yeah. No, I enjoyed those bits. I like those characters.
Just to make it a bit more, you know, light-hearted.
Murder punctuated with light-hearted intervals.
Yeah, something like that. Right,
back to what we're supposed to be talking about, I guess.
We I say this all the time. We go off at a tangent because we're friends talking about what we love. So, where did this topic spring from?
Yeah, I think that was my fault. So, yes.
Yes, you did mention it. We were all like, what?
Yeah, I think it stemmed from, I was probably like looking up something on the internet about, I like reading quite a lot of Golden Age detective fiction, and I imagine it came about while I was delving into some of that. So, and the Detection Club, I imagine that's part of it. I did read a while back Martin Edwards' book about Golden Age crime fiction, and it could quite possibly have come from there. So, and it is a very good book, and I think there's certainly libraries in Warrington where we are that stock it. So if you're interested, maybe have a look in your local library, see if they have it, or if you can interlibrary loan it or whatever it might happen to be. Or you could buy it from a bookshop, maybe even an independent one.
Yes, that'd be good.
It would. Yes. So, Ronald Knox, he seemed like an interesting guy.
He does. He had lots of fingers in lots of pies by the looks of it.
He absolutely did, yes. Well, I think he converted to Catholicism, but he was an English Catholic priest, a theologian, an author, a radio broadcaster, one of the founding members of the Detection Club, and he also wrote 5 detective novels and I think some short stories too.
I didn't just sit about there.
A busy chap.
Crocheting or anything like that.
Well, it's not recorded if he did.
Making mead or whatever, yeah.
You're getting confused with Cab File.
I am, aren't I?
Possibly.
Yeah. We were just talking about that before we started recording. Mm. So I love this. This 10 Commandments for Detective Stories. Which, you know, there's do's and don'ts in this.
Yeah. And whodunits were a big thing.
Oh, they were. They were massive then, weren't they?
Yeah, if you think of Golden Age crime, you think of whodunits. So, yes, he kind of attempted to come up with, you know, commandments or, you know, a kind of a code to abide by for detective novelists because he was, you know, a big part of the Detection Club. So,
do we know who else was in the Detection Club? Anybody famous?
Oh, I think if you were any sort of detective writer, detective novelist, you were in the Detection. I'm pretty sure Agatha Christie was.
Yeah.
Nia Marsh probably was.
Was that before?
Oh, I think it might have been after his time.
Yeah.
But yeah, lots of people who, I mean, I think some of them are still around today. Some of them less so. But yes, I'll have to look up a list of members of the Detection Club.
Yeah, yeah. We'll do that because, as I say, it was quite a powerful group when it came to crime writing. According to this man, a detective story must have as its main interest the unravelling of a mystery whose elements are clearly presented to the reader at an early stage in the proceedings and whose nature is such as to arouse curiosity, a curiosity which is gratified at the end. Mm. We've said this before. We don't want the ending that doesn't make sense to us. We don't want somebody being parachuted in that wasn't in the rest of the story.
Yeah, you want to feel satisfied. Yes. You want to be like, yes. And maybe you want to have a bit of, oh, if only I'd noticed that.
Yeah.
But you want to feel like, you know, you've been played fair with. You don't want to feel like, well, you know, if I'd known that so-and-so had a snake farm, I would obviously have got that. But yes, Detection Club.
Right.
Guess who's been on the internet? Was formed in 1930 by a group of 26 British crime writers, including Anthony Barclay, Agatha Christie, Dorothy L. Sayers, G.K. Chesterton, A.A. Milne.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Winnie the Pooh, Reign of Terror.
Yeah.
sorry. Ronald Knox. There he is. Freeman Willis Crofts, Arthur Morrison, John Rowe, Jesse Rickard, Baroness Ortsey.
Oh.
So there you go. There were quite a few of them. I think it's still going now. Yes. So, yes, it does. Interestingly, it says here the club continues to exist, though the fair play rules have been considerably relaxed.
Oh, right.
Mm. So this might inform our discussion.
It might do that, mm. Yes. So we're going to take one point at a time and discuss it. So I'll do the first one.
Yeah.
The criminals must be mentioned in the early part of the story, but must not be anyone whose thoughts the readers have been allowed to know.
Ooh.
Does that make sense? The criminal must be mentioned in the early part of the story, but must not be anyone whose thoughts the readers have been allowed to know.
I agree. They should certainly be there from at least the first half.
Mm. Yes. Yeah.
You know, you can't really have someone turning up at, like, you know, the 85%. Point if you're reading on your ebook and then it's like, oh, well, it was them. It's like, well, come on now.
Yeah.
You know, that's not playing fair.
Yeah.
But yeah, the thing about the thoughts the reader hasn't been allowed to know, I think that's reasonable because if you know their thoughts, presumably they will be thinking about the murder.
They will be, yes.
Yeah. So it makes sense to me.
How they're getting away with it, what they're going to do for the next one. It'd all be up there, wouldn't it, in their.
Yeah. I mean, you would, I suppose, have to know that they were their thoughts, because I'm thinking of a particular book of yours. Mm. Mm. So, have you ever contravened this in any way?
Might have done.
Yeah. Then I've got her on the ropes there, listeners. Yes.
Yeah, that rule one broken by me.
Whoops. But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one, that, isn't it?
Yes.
Because I'm sure there will be, you know, perfectly good, readable books where, you know, you do know somebody's thoughts, but I mean, you know a limited portion of them.
Mm. Yeah.
So,
it's how much and how you.
It's whether you decide that's not fair dealing or not.
Well, true, but, yes. Yeah. So I'm very sorry, Mr. Knox.
But yes, I'm thinking about a Golden Age detective novelist who has the thoughts of someone in their book, but you don't know whose they are.
Oh, now that's good. Isn't it? Mm. So you've got this sort of internal dialogue, but you don't know whose it is.
Yes.
Oh, right.
Exactly. So every so often you'll get a little bit of it and you think, oh, gosh, you know, ooh. So you feel like, oh, wow, I've been let into something here. And, like, you know, the detective doesn't know.
Mm. So, no.
But yes, of course, it is a cunning double bluff.
Yes. They usually are, aren't they? Yeah.
But yes. Okay. Point two. All supernatural or preternatural agencies are ruled out as a matter of course. Well, that's me scupping, definitely. Certainly in some series, but yes, I think my ghost policewoman might have a slight problem here.
She would, wouldn't she?
She would. Not to mention the magical bookshop.
Exactly. And the ones I'm reading at the moment, the Stranger...
Oh, the Stranger Times series.
That would definitely be not allowed, you know, sort of thing. But we love those sort of things. I love it when there's a supernatural element in it.
Yeah, and the thing is, I sort of feel like, well, provided that the rules are consistent and it's not just a case of, oh, well, you know, someone can actually fly and they just swoop down and made off with them or whatever it is, or, you know, they fixed them with their death ray glare and that's why we couldn't find the weapon.
Yeah, and they melted them with their death ray glare.
Yeah, I mean, that's just not playing fair, melting people.
No.
There ought to be a law.
Yeah. So that is something that I should imagine has been well sort of looked at and thought, maybe we don't use that one anymore.
Yeah, I think if everyone's aware of the rules of the world, though.
Yeah.
The world that you're in.
Yes. Yes. That's right. Yes.
Because certainly when I read the Stranger Times book, I didn't feel at all cheated as if I wasn't being played fair with.
No, because, again, the characters are... They make you laugh such a lot, even when there's dark things going on, you know.
Yeah.
the characters are brilliant in that.
Mm.
Number three, not more than one secret room or passage is allowed. Well, again,
yeah, I'm shaking ground again here. Oh dear. Yeah. I'm not doing, I should never have suggested this.
No, I might have
voiced by my own petard.
Yeah, I might have done something like that as well. But yeah, I mean, you don't, again, you don't want to be, you know, you're in a big manor house and every room's got a secret door in it. And
yeah, that's just confusing.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd get lost anyway. Mm. I wouldn't go in, actually. There'd be spiders in there.
But that's true. I mean, maybe not, you know, multiples of the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
So, you know, maybe one undiscovered basement, one, you know, mysterious way down to the underground river.
Yeah.
I think that's perfectly acceptable in the same book.
Yeah.
Personally.
Yes, so do I.
Moving swiftly on. Okay. No hitherto undiscovered poisons may be used, nor any appliance which will need a long scientific explanation at the end. I mean, I'm inclined to agree with that.
Oh, yeah. if, again, it's sort of, you know, it's death rays and things like that.
Untraceable poisons. Yeah, that's just not
I mean, one of my favourites at the moment of something that's hard to discover is guns that are made on 3D printers.
Oh, yes.
Because apparently the only thing that's left, if you sort of melt them down, is the firing pin, which is metal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, you could eat that, couldn't you?
I'd rather not. But
what I'm saying is it's easy to dispose of.
I'd rather have a Tonics tea cake, if you don't mind.
Yeah, well, true. But as I say, it's...
that's an interesting one.
You could stick it in a pot plant or anything, couldn't you? And I've seen this used in a couple of sort of television series where...
Oh.
There's been a 3D gun made. I think it can only be fired once, but I'm not sure.
Yeah,
But
anything where you have some kind of long-winded scientific explanation at the end does not sound like a fun read to me.
Well, Quincy sometimes did that, didn't he?
I don't know.
When he was doing the scientific bit at the end.
Hate to say it was possibly before my time.
Probably was.
Sorry, Carol.
Well before your
Sorry,
time.
Carol.
Yeah, he used to go into all reams of, you know, why this couldn't have happened. I'm not saying they were scientific, but he sometimes then you'd be like, when did that happen? I must have missed that bit.
You may have been asleep.
I might have been asleep, yes, yeah.
Right.
So the next one, which is, I love, no Chinaman must figure in the story. Note, this is a reference to the common use of heavily stereotyped Asian characters in detective fiction at the time. Having looked at, you know, watched some old Sherlock Holmes and things like that, they were there, weren't they?
Oh, mysterious, like, yes, Orientals, mysterious colonials who've come from overseas to cause trouble or whatever. It's, yeah, that's one of the things that really quite annoys me with some of the Sherlock Holmes stories where, you know, it's, you know, so clearly it couldn't be a British person.
No.
Or whatever. Yeah, whatever. Yeah. So yes, I am inclined to go with that.
Yes, we'll
heavily stereotyped racial divisions. No, thank you.
No.
Okay, number six. No accident must ever help the detective, nor must he ever have an unaccountable intuition which proves to be right.
I just know, Sherlock.
Well, no accident must ever help the detective. The thing is, I mean, we were talking about how your reading influences, you know, indirectly what you write. And I kind of feel like, well, you know, surely if something happens, you think, oh, hang on a minute. Is that related to that or whatever? Or I could do this.
I think a woman's intuition, because a lot of our books are, you know, we've got lots of
strong female characters.
A woman's intuition about a character, I'm not saying they might be, you know, going that they're a murderer, but, you know, like something that just makes you feel uncomfortable about somebody and you can't pinpoint it.
Yeah.
Would that come into
an
accountable intuition?
I think quite often your gut feeling is based on something, but just because you don't know what it is, that doesn't mean that it's not correct.
No.
Because, you know, your subconscious notices all sorts of things. It's like that thing about if you've got a problem, you know, go and sleep on it. In the morning, you'll, you know, your subconscious will have worked through it all for you.
Yeah.
You know, and just because you don't quite know how you got to that doesn't mean it's the wrong suggestion. So, yeah.
I think you can use that.
Because if it's completely unaccountable, but I think if, you know, if something leads the detective to the right answer and maybe it is a chance happening or an encounter, and yeah, I'm guilty of this one, definitely.
As I say, sometimes it's just police will say they had a gut feeling about things. You know, but again, it's, have they picked up on body language? Is there something in the subconscious that is leading them that way, that they've seen or heard? You know, it's it's very easy to say, oh, it's I've just got a good eye for these things, when sometimes there's a lot of stuff going on there.
I think if it helps you make the link, and you can, you know, you can make that link and then it makes a solid connection which is provable, then I think it's fair enough. Personally,
yes, I agree with that. So, is it me?
It is you.
The detective himself must not commit the crime.
Don't think I've done that one.
I haven't either.
No, but I can think of occasions when it's happened. I was going to say, perfectly good books.
Yeah, I know. I know. In some things I've watched, read, and heard, the detective has been the murderer at the end of it. You know,
I mean, in a long running series, I guess you don't want that happening too often. No, that would not be good. Yes, but I can think of a very famous example of that one, which I will not talk about here. Okay, the detective is bound to declare any clues which he may discover. Yes, I agree.
Yeah. Because otherwise, what's the point of having the clues?
Well, I mean, that would not enable you to solve who done it. Though a difference is, I suppose it depends who they're with.
Yeah, I was going to say, and
there might be circumstances where, you know, in a later scene, because they don't want to show whatever it is in front of whichever person who might have an interest in it. So,
and the old saying of show, don't tell. We try and do that in all fiction, but sometimes you've got to. It's the sort of thing where they would discuss it with a colleague, wouldn't they? That's what would happen in my books. They'd talk about it. Cassie and Wen would discuss a clue and see where it was. Because very often it leads to more investigation, the clue. So, and obviously as the reader, you write that one down. That's okay, that's leading towards something.
Yeah, I think so.
The detective is bound to declare any...
Oh, we've done that one.
Oh, we have, sorry. The sidekick of the detectives, the Watson, must not conceal from the reader any thoughts which pass through his mind. His intelligence must be slightly, but very slightly, below that of the average reader.
Oh, there's so much to unpack here, isn't there? Who is the average reader?
I know.
Oh, gosh.
That's a bit of an insult to Watson as well.
Poor Watson. It also assumes that, it seems to assume that every detective will have a sidekick.
Yeah, no, every detective does have a sidekick.
No. I mean, I suppose the thing is, you know, if you're writing a police procedural, then you will have, you know, your chief inspector.
Yeah.
Then you'll have like various, you know, officers of a lower rank, but I mean, does that make them sidekicks or
no?
I wouldn't have thought of them. I wouldn't have thought of Cassie, for example, or Colin as sidekicks to Wen.
No, they're colleagues. And she, I mean, I feel Cassie and Wen are of an equal standing in the squad.
Yeah,
they both come at things slightly differently, but they do share information. So no, none of mine have a sidekick. I think poor Colin gets used as one now and again.
Yes, he does a bit,
because he tends to get paired up with partners who are female and quite dominating. So if he's not careful, he gets sidelined. And
you're right, actually. Yeah, Colin is a good example of someone who's kind of pushed into the sidekick role and, you know, quite often resents it.
Yeah.
Especially if he's being pushed into it by someone of equal rank, which is a bit harsh, really.
Yeah, so he's always trying to stand his ground and go, "You actually, I'm your senior." And they just ignore him because he's a nice guy.
But yes, I mean, do you think do you think detectives ought to have sidekicks?
It's the, when you go back to, and look at how we used to read detectives' stories, there usually was, wasn't there? You know, I'm thinking about like...
Well, if you think of Poirot and Hastings.
Yeah.
Holmes and Watson, obviously.
Holmes and Watson, yeah, they're the ones that jump to mind.
Yeah. I mean, you think of others. I mean, you know, think of Mowbray, for example.
Yeah.
You know, he seems very much a lone
He was
operator.
Alone, yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, Miss Marple didn't have anybody. She had everybody and nobody, didn't she, Miss Marple?
Yes.
Because she could just get as much information out of people as she needed.
Yeah. And then if you think of, well, Tommy and Tuppence. That's an interesting one. I mean, I kind of think of Tuppence as being the, you know, the main character.
Yes.
And Tommy's sort of...
He's a bit, yeah. He bumbles a bit,
doesn't
he?
More of a sidekick. Yeah. Although, you know, a hero in his own right.
Yeah. So, I mean, I must admit, when I'm watching crime, I do like it if there's a play or a film or something that where they've got a sidekick. I do like it.
What do you think of, Inspector Alain and Fox? Fox would be the sidekick, wouldn't he? Well, sometimes I suppose Troy is.
Yes. Yeah.
Fulfilling that role.
Yeah.
So.
Yes, that's a bit. We can leave that one open because
it's an interesting one.
Yes, it is.
Yes, must not conceal from the reader any thoughts which pass through. I'm going to say their mind rather than his mind.
Yeah. And as I say, it's a sharing of information. I mean, usually a sidekick would go to the person that they're working with and go, oh, "I've just seen Carruthers." And, you know, he says that he doesn't have a gun, but I know he does have a gun.
And I suppose the thing about the level of intelligence is partly so that we, the reader, get to feel, you know, smart and, you know, the Watson character, I don't understand why that would possibly be anything. Ooh, I know.
Yeah.
And you get to feel a bit smug.
Yeah.
You've got something that they didn't.
Yes.
So, yes.
Part of the unwrapping, isn't it?
Yeah, that little reward you get as you go along.
Yeah.
Right, and the final commandment, twin brothers and doubles generally must not appear unless we have been duly prepared for them. I love that.
Oh, yes.
I can think of certainly a story there, yes, which hinges on that. Not one of mine.
Yeah.
One of a Golden Age author. So
well, that's
go.
It. And it does come up now and again, doesn't it? I mean, I must admit, when I'm watching something and I'm thinking, I wonder, you know, they couldn't have been there because they were in Brighton, you know, and this happened in Scotland. I'm thinking, I wonder if they had a twin. First thing that comes into my head, you know, when they've obviously been seen somewhere else.
Yeah, I think that's the kind of thing you can really have a good play with, though, because, I think we have been conditioned to think, oh, well, you know, maybe they'd have a double.
Yeah. But as we discussed once before, we now know that even identical twins don't carry the same DNA. So this sometimes would scupper the twin theory.
Yes.
But if you're looking for confusion...
Mm.
You know, if you want something to throw people's ideas, it's very easily done.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it could just be somebody sat in a room with a wig on, you know, dressed as the person that's actually gone out to do the murder, couldn't it? You know, somebody's watching them from another building with binoculars.
Yes.
It's not really them. But yes, we need to know. It is, again, not for at all if where this twin brother or body double pops up at the end and goes, it's a fair cop, Gov, I did it.
But yeah, so all in all then, do you agree or disagree with the commandments?
I probably disagree with a lot of them.
Right. Go on. Why? Why?
I just think we've moved on so much now. And some of the things that we're asked for in this would stop so many writers these days from producing really entertaining storylines.
Yeah. I mean, I think I agree with the principles behind the commandments.
Yes. Yeah.
But, you know, not always necessarily the commandments themselves, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah, it does. So, because, as I say, we can have a twin who's involved, but quite rightly says here, we must know about it.
Yeah.
Not in the last chapter.
Yeah.
You know, we need to know about it fairly.
Yeah. I mean, I think what these are really about is producing a satisfying crime story where your reader has a fair chance at the end thinks, you know, I should have got that, or I could have got that. Not, yeah. Well, there's no way I could ever have got that and I feel cheated now.
I mean, if they think, and I've done this myself, I've read something and I've gone, that is very clever.
I
did not see that.
Oh, I love those.
That is a lovely sort of end to a book for me, you know, and you're like, wow.
Yeah.
I remember you don't feel cheated.
No, you're like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember reading a Josephine Tay book. I won't say which one because I don't want to spoil it. I'd be like, ooh. Yeah, in fact, generally with Josephine Tay books, I think I really enjoy them.
Yeah.
So, yes. I mean, I don't know if she was in the Detection Club. I suspect she might have been.
Probably was. Mm. I read a book not long ago that somebody recommended to me. And the plot was fine, but I wasn't taken that much with the writer. It's probably I probably won't read any more of his books, but there was like a little bit just at the end, and it was like, oh, that's good, you know. That there was just a little tiny twist that made you think, yeah, that's exactly what should have happened. You know, when you think somebody's got away with something. So.
Oh, I remember reading a book, and again, I won't say which one because spoilers, and thinking, oh, that is such a nice little kind of twist of the knife moment. And when I watched the TV adaptation, they hadn't put it in.
Oh, what a letdown. I was just like,
oh, how could you?
Yeah, no. So there is, you know, that is... I think that's what, as writers, that we're aiming for, that lovely feeling of satisfaction at the end of a book.
Mm.
And it's, again, we've said this before, it's the fact that everything's right with the world again, you know. The killer's been found, there's going to be justice for the family, the detective's been proven right when everybody was saying he was going the wrong way about the whole thing, and everybody's vindicated, you know, and it's like, yes. I mean, I've watched some television series lately where somebody really, really bad ended up in prison, and before they've gone to trial, somebody in prison's killed them, and you've thought, well, I didn't want that to happen. that's left me feeling a bit like let down. I was hoping they'd go to trial and everything, and it's that sometimes that's a bit of a get out as well, isn't it? You kill somebody when they're in custody, sort of. So I think that is our conclusion on this particular episode. Interesting, and as I say, it's nice to pick these things apart sometimes and look at them from our point of view. So yes, thank you very much for listening today. Hope you've enjoyed it. Hit all the buttons. We don't care if you don't, actually. We just want you to listen to it. And I can't say our sponsors want you to do that because we don't have sponsors. but yes, and join us next time for the next episode of Only Murders in My Mind. And until then, stay safe. Bye.
Bye.
You have been listening to Only Murders in My Mind, a Random Thought production. Produced by John Bissett. The music, In Peril, was composed and recorded by OM Studio Strings.